This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. My name is Greg Jarrett. Welcome to the CAPS Forum on Ethics and Public Policy. This is an event we hold each quarter to bring in a distinguished scholar to speak to and interact with students from a diverse group of disciplines united by a common interest, such as sex. Interaction with the speaker is part of the mission of the forum. We look forward to your questions, and there will be at least 30 minutes for discussion. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I would like to thank the participating faculty. I'd like to thank Todd Gillespie and the whole video crew for UCTV. I'd like to thank Leonard Wallach and the entire CAPS Center staff for their hard work in making this come together. Finally, I'd like to thank all the healthy young students pushing the boundaries of sexual possibility. Elena has a sign-up sheet for the Walter CAPS Center. If you want to get further emails, you want to just wave that. I think there's one in the back if you want to get further emails from the CAP Center and be in contact with about our events. Tonight, we're privileged and honored to have Dr. Paul Abramson, professor of psychology at UCLA, where he studies human sexuality and its crossroads with constitutional law. Dr. Abramson is the former editor of the Journal of Sex Research, a technical advisor for the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS, and is commonly called as an expert witness on sexual abuse cases. Paul is the author and co-author of more than 100 articles and 10 books, including Sarah, A Sexual Biography, Sexual Rights in America, The Ninth Amendment and the Pursuit of Happiness, A Divided House, Suspicions of Mother-Daughter Incest, With Pleasure, Thoughts on the Nature of Human Sexuality, Romance in the Ivory Tower, The Rights and Liberties of Conscience, and his latest book, Sex Appeal, Six Ethical Principles for the 21st Century. Clearly, Dr. Abramson is a researcher of rock star caliber. And as proof, I'm going to plug his band, Crying for Kafka, who will be performing at Muddy Waters Cafe on Friday. 9 o'clock, right? That's a first for a CAPS event. Tonight, he would like to speak to us about sex, and more sex, ensuring sexual rights while preventing sexual harm. Please welcome Dr. Paul Abramson.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here. These are values that I hold dear as well. I also knew Lisa Capps, that was Walter and Lois's daughter, who died a number of years ago. She got her PhD at UCLA and ultimately became an assistant professor at University of California, Berkeley. And I ran into her many years ago at a Santa Barbara Film Festival. And we just happened to be sitting next to each other, and we started talking, and I said, oh, what are you doing here for this? And she said, oh, my dad just got elected to Congress, and we're having a party. And she was just beaming. And so I followed the CAPS through that arc. What I'd like to start with are several rhetorical questions. And when I teach my human sexuality or sex and law classes at UCLA, I tell people, you know, if you're going to raise your hand, you're raising it about a friend, and it's a friend no one in this room knows about. So if you feel like you have to nod or raise your hand, yes, whatever else, that you're doing it anonymously. I want to start with a couple questions about kids. Does a 12-year-old kid have a right to masturbate? Does he or she have a constitutional right to masturbate? What if their parents want to prohibit it or punish them for doing that? Do they have a right to do it? Something to think about. What about dating? Well, let's take this like a 14-year-old. What if a 14-year-old kid is starting to date? And does he or she have the right to date? Does he or she have the right to kiss? Does he or she have the right to touch sexually? What if their parents want to prohibit it or punish them for it? Whose rights prevail in this situation? Now, the common way of thinking of this, you know, parents sort of rule the roost. But from my perspective, the forefront of sexual rights are really the rights of kids. What are kids' sexual rights? Do kids have constitutional rights? And if so, how do we implement those? And I want to sort of take you back into some controversial territory, and this is Roe versus Wade. And I know UCSB has this little tempest in a teapot about that going on right now. But if you listen to Roe v. Wade, and it was audio tape, so you actually can listen to it or read the transcripts of it, I mean, the way we characterize it generally is about it's about women's rights and reproductive rights and so forth. But it was really about conflicting rights. And the justices were open to the idea of fetal rights and, of course, maternal rights. But it came down to this particular question where generally when you think of constitutional rights, the holders of constitutional rights are persons or people. So the justices were asking, basically the state of Texas, just give us some bona fide medical evidence that an unborn fetus is a person. And when Texas couldn't do that, then it was no longer about competing rights. It was one person's rights, which were maternal rights, who could embrace and enjoy all the constitutional rights accorded to that person. The other thing about Roe v. Wade is that the state of Texas, you can hear this discussion in Roe v. Wade as well, that the state of Texas allowed abortion. What they didn't allow was doctor-assisted abortion. A woman could self-abort, and not that wasn't a criminal act. And the justices were saying, you know, you're talking about all these fetal rights and you're pro-fetal rights, whatever else. I mean, if that was the case, why not criminalize all abortion? And instead of just criminalizing doctor-assisted abortion. And I raise these points because I want to go back to the rhetorical questions I started with. Is a 14-year-old kid a person? Is a 12-year-old kid a person? And if they are, you're no longer talking about what happened in Roe v. Wade, which was one rights holder and an individual entity without rights. Now you have potential two rights holders. You have the parents and the child, or teenager and so forth, having rights as well. And by the way, kids do have constitutional rights. And the case that accorded constitutional rights is called In re Gault. Gault was the last name, G-A-U-L-T. And the story behind that was Gerald Gault lived, he's from Arizona. And to understand this case, you have to understand a few characteristics of juvenile litigation in Arizona. The first was that Arizona thought, you know, why should we gum up all these kind of juvenile hearings with lawyers? Let's get rid of lawyers and just have this kind of benevolent, benign judge, which is usually a he, you know, just think of what's the best thing for kids. And let him make the decision. So what that meant, in effect, was that no lawyers were involved in either prosecuting or defending juvenile defendants in Arizona's court system. The second characteristic of Arizona, which was significant, was that if a teenager, let's say, was convicted, they were sentenced to Fort Gault. Fort Hood. And in it was called Fort Grant. And in Fort Grant was off in the desert, and the inmates used to have to do 30-mile forced marches without water. There was a high suicide rate. There was a high physical abuse, high sexual abuse, and so forth. So if a kid did get convicted, he or she, but primarily he, was sent to Fort Grant. And in this particular, what happened in this particular case, so that's sort of the backdrop of this case. What happened in this particular case was that Gerald Galt lived in a trailer park. And some of the trailers had telephones while others didn't. And a friend of his came over his house and said, "Can I use your phone?" Gerald said, "Sure." So thinking that the kid's gonna call his parents, whatever else. So the kid, at least this is the way Gerald described it. The kid gets out of the phone and makes a phony phone call. He calls a woman named Ida Cook and asks her things like, "How big are your bombers?" and stuff like that. And she was annoyed, as rightly so, by the phone call. She called the police. And the police were able to track the phone call, and it came from Galt's trailer. So they went and they arrested Gerald. And Gerald said, "You know, I didn't even make that call. This kid, my friend, came over and he made the call." And they didn't believe him, so they told him that your hearing's Monday. And his mother was really disturbed about this because she wanted a lawyer, because he's there saying, "I didn't even make the call." But they told him the same thing that I prefaced this with. "Oh, you know, it's a benevolent judge, don't worry, you know, he'll weigh justice appropriately, you have nothing really to worry about." friends and an attorney she knew assured her of that. Anyway, he gets in there. Judge listened to the story, said, "You know what? This kid is a constant criminal, has a constant criminal mind. We're sending away to Fort Grant." Now, the significance about this process, it was literally that quick, was that he was not represented by an attorney. Ida Cook never showed up. So, you know, all defendants usually get to face their accusers. So he never got to face his accuser. And that was significant for a couple reasons, one of which was that he said, "It wasn't my voice. It was this other kid's voice." So she couldn't identify the voice. There also was no transcript of the call. So you didn't really know what it was other than her testimony about it. And he was sentenced. He was given an indeterminate sentence, which was a minimum of 5 years for this phony phone call, this double entendre phony phone call. If he was an adult and convicted of an obscene phone call, it's a $50 fine and a maximum of 60 days in jail. And because he, you know, as this juvenile, without representation and so forth, he gets this indeterminate sentence. Now, if he had an attorney, the attorney would obviously want his accuser there. He'd want a transcript of this talk. He'd want her to be able to identify his voice from others. And also possibly using an expert witness. Was this phone call obscene? And the significance about that particular question was, at that time, given my knowledge of rock and roll, there was a popular song that was called "Shake, Rattle, Roll." There were two versions. Big Joe Turner started, and I can't remember who, maybe it was Bill Haley or whatever else, had a version of it going around the same time. One of the lines in that song is, "I'm a one-eyed cat peeking in a seafood store." I'm not going to tell you what the one-eyed cat is, or the seafood store for that matter, but just presume it's a sexual double entendre. And there are other references to this. Catcher in the Rye has sexual double entendres, and it was deemed not obscene. A couple years after this case, Fanny Hill was deemed not obscene, which is a very sexually explicit novel. So even the question of whether this was truly an obscene phone call was debatable. So, you know, Galt gets sentenced for this indeterminate sentence, but ultimately goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court rules that, you know what, kids have constitutional rights. You cannot deny life, liberty, property without a due process or fair process of the law. And from that case, and that case was, the original incident happened in 64, and I think the case was decided in the mid-60s. From that point on, it was determined kids have constitutional rights. They have rights to education. They have rights to all sorts of things. Which brings me back to my original rhetorical questions. The forefront of the questions about sexual rights are really about the rights of kids. And bringing it to contemporary times, The average age of beginning sexual relations or the onset of intercourse is 16. What's the age of consent in California?
18.
It's 18. So there are a lot of kids who are potentially engaging in illegal sexual acts. Some of it can be interpreted, again, you have to leave it up to benign district attorney who would use these Romeo and Juliet perspectives on it. But the real crux of it is if one person, let's say it's an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old, someone above the age of consent having sex with someone below the age of consent is statutory rape. The significance of that designation is that in criminal law, there are only a few what are referred to as non mens rea crimes, strict liability crimes. It means whatever the basis of criminal law is that a guilty act in a guilty mind. Non mens rea means you take the mind part out. So statutory rape is you do it, doesn't matter what you're thinking, doesn't matter what you were told, doesn't matter, it's a strict liability crime. You do it, it's a felony offense. And the rationale, sort of historical rationale for this, was that, you know, they'd arrest an older man and a younger girl, historically, and the guy would say, she told me she was 18, or she looked 18, or whatever else. So they just got rid of all of that. It's a strict liability offense. It doesn't matter what you say. If you engage in it, it's statutory rape. But it's even more complicated than that because the age of consent varies by state. Like, although it's 18 in California, it's 16 in Connecticut. So if a kid moves from Connecticut to California, would he or she understand that? That this is sort of state-specific. In Kentucky, by the way, it's 14. And when the United States first codified an age of consent, it was 10. Age of sexual consent, it was 10. That was in the 1800s. So there's an enormous amount of confusion just about the concept of consent. And consent is a really complicated construct because in order to give consent to sex, you have to understand two parts of this equation, one of which you have to act with volition. That means you're acting voluntarily. And the second part is you have to understand the knowledge and consequences of your act. So the complicated nuance is that can a significantly mentally ill person consent to sex? Do they understand the nature and consequences of what they're doing? Can they act with volition? The reason why district attorneys, and this is stuff that comes up in college campuses, will take cases where one party is drunk and afterwards said, you know, I didn't consent to sex. They take those cases because the two-part process of consenting to sex is acting with volition. You have to understand and act voluntarily. If you're knocked out on drugs or comatose, you're not consenting, no matter what's going on. And the nuances related to the developmentally disabled or the mentally ill is that, you know, they have the same physical expressions and needs as everyone else. But can they get to that point where they clearly understand the nature and consequences of what they're doing? So, which is another sort of area of the law that's quite interesting where sexual rights are concerned. Some of these other nuances that apply to kids are like sexting, you know, like writing texts to each other and very sexually explicit. If it's sent to a kid, that's potentially harmful matter to a child, which could be a felony offense, even if the kids are exchanging it with each other. Or photographs, nude photographs of each other, could be deemed child pornography. And again, I'm bringing these things up not to exaggerate the possibilities, but to hit, if you look at this historically, all the way back to Galt, this was a kid who, whether he or his friend was asking something about our, you know, how big are your bombers, goes off to jail because they believed in the benevolence of the judicial system. When you're left to believing in the benevolence of the judicial system, you have these sorts of complications. And the messages that kids get around these areas are also complicated. I don't know if any of you saw Crazy Stupid Love. It was a major motion picture. If you raised your hand if you saw that.
So, I saw it.
All right, so a few people saw it. Crazy Stupid Love. So I'll give you this is the synopsis of what went on there. It was a 40-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 12-year-old, let's say. The 40-year-old was male, the 17-year-old was female, and the 12-year-old was male. The 12-year-old had a crush on the 17, and the 17-year-old had a crush on the 40-year-old. But the 17-year-old started thinking, you know, this 40-year-old guy doesn't know that I'm really hot for him, I really want him, whatever else. So she takes these erotic pictures of herself to give to him. And the feel-good ending of this Hollywood, it was a kind of feel-good movie. The feel-good ending of this movie was that she realizes that, you know, he's better off with his wife, wherever else was. And it's kind of a goodbye, warm and fuzzy goodbye gesture on her part. She gives the pictures to the 12-year-old to use for his masturbation. And, of course, he's thrilled, whatever else. That's child pornography and the distribution of child pornography. I mean, what message is it giving to kids as well about how do you navigate through these kinds of things? And going back to the original question, imagine instead that 14-year-old kid's dating, okay? They have the right to date, the right to kiss, the right to sexually touch. What if the kid's gay or lesbian? Does he or she have the right to date at 14? Does she or he have the right to kiss at 14? Does she or he have the right to sexually touch at that age? What if parents prohibit it? What if parents punish them for it? And from my perspective, those are the kinds of cases that will determine and build these rights, because you're more likely to get the sort of parental vehemence of those things and the sense of entitlement that they can't do this. I'm the parent, I can choose this. But if you look at, I mean, what's embodied in the philosophy of the Constitution is the Declaration of Independence. You know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Is our sexual expression part of our pursuit of happiness? Is it so for a teenager? And if it is, should they have the same kind of constitutional protections about sex or some variation of them that adults do? So that's one area that I'm working in, and where a book is coming out called Kids, Sex, and the Law, that a number of scholars who work in this area are trying to piece these things together in anticipation of litigation. You may have recalled this, but there was, I think the state of Virginia prosecuted Abercrombie and Fitch for their ads saying that they were child pornography. And they're, the things that I'm bringing up are not so outlandish as the potential for ending up in litigation. And to give you a simple example of this, I worked on a Supreme Court appeal recently. When I mentioned earlier about the value of the Capstone Institute, this is one of the many things I do for sort of public service. Is I did this as a pro bono effort to work on this case, and it involved a prisoner in Utah. He was in jail, let's say, for theft, and he had continuous contact with his wife and daughter. And she asked him, said, "Would you draw a picture like we saw on Discovery Channel, like the cave art of me and you?" So he said, "All right." And he's a prisoner in jail, and you know, he does the drawing. The prison intercepts it, looks at it. It's just a stick figure drawing, and looks at it and said, "Oh, this is obscene matter." And rearrested him for sending obscene matter to a child through the mail. When he was convicted in Utah, the Utah Supreme Court convicted him as well. And a UCLA professor and I, law professor and I, took it all the way to Supreme Court in appealing in his behalf. He had the unfortunate last name of Butt. So this was the Butt family. And in the drawing, he's holding his daughter up saying, I'm going to bite your butt. And in the butt family, butts had sort of different kind of connotation and meaning and familiarity than elsewhere. The justices agreed to look at the case, but so we made it to the top 2%, but ultimately did not decide on the case. But that, you know, this is an anatomically correct drawing. And one of the things that I was able to demonstrate in this was that, you know, the U.S. government had its own website with these kind of drawings in it. And the drawings were essential for detecting sexual abuse. That's what the website was about. And I think it was the National Institute of Health or National Institute of Mental Health had a website devoted to detecting child sexual abuse. And part of the protocols that you could find the website were anatomically correct stick drawings. So I could give other instances of the manner in which these things erupt when you don't have sort of a solid foundation or anticipate what should be the sustaining rights for these individuals or groups. So I want to shift at this point to adults. And a lot of my work has been on resurrecting the Ninth Amendment. And in case you don't know what the Ninth Amendment is, I'm going to read you the Ninth Amendment. It's generally referred to as rights retained by the people. So the Ninth Amendment reads as follows. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And the way the Ninth Amendment evolved was that the Federalists didn't want a Bill of Rights. They said, you know, if there's a Bill of Rights, the government's going to say anything you didn't list above on this Bill of Rights, we have jurisdiction over. But the anti-federalists want a Bill of Rights. They point out, you know, all of our states had bills of rights and we cherish them. So there's this debate back and forth, and to ratify the Constitution, you need all the states to agree to this. So James Madison figured out this perfect compromise, which was the Ninth Amendment. He said, you know, okay, this is what I'll do. I'm going to say, despite those rights enumerated above, people still retain rights that are unenumerated. And that is a compromise. So, okay, we listed some up, satisfying the states who wanted bills of rights, and the Federalists who didn't want a Bill of Rights. It was reversed. So the anti-Federalists who wanted this as protection against the encroachment of all these rights, this was a compromise. You know, we've listed what was enumerated, but there's still rights retained by the people. But what's happened with this amendment is that over time, the Supreme Court has by and large decided, let's ignore it. Let's act as if it doesn't exist. Because it's just too complicated. I mean, what are the unenumerated rights? I mean, some have argued it's what our natural rights are. The rights that we have that weren't accorded to us by a government, by a monarchy, whatever else. They're just the rights we're born to. Do you have a right to be free? Do you have a right to liberty? Did you get that right because the government gave that to you? Or was that preceded governments? And so one of the arguments that I've made in this is that, you know, although it's not explicitly listed in the First Eight Amendments or anywhere else in the Constitution, we must have the right to reproduce. You know, if you didn't have the right to reproduce, there would be no people. So, but the way you exercise rights is through choice. So you must have the right to reproduce or choose not to reproduce. And how could you choose not to reproduce? You could have mutual masturbation, you could have oral sex, you could have same-gendered sex, contraception, abortion, so forth. These are part of our rights to choose not to reproduce. And the significance of this perspective is that it varies enormously from the general perspective about our sexual rights. We have no sexual rights. We have no putative sexual rights. And I learned this while I was working for the World Health Organization in the late 1980s when we were doing all this global program on AIDS outreach. At that point in time, there was no therapeutic intervention for HIV. Everything was about education, education, education. And in many countries, they were putting up billboards of a erect penis with a condom on it. You know, play safely, very, very sexually explicit, but putting it out there to get people to be aware. You need condoms, all sort of about condom sense. And I asked, I said, well, why aren't we doing any of this in the United States? They said, well, you know, in the United States, they wouldn't even allow you to mention condoms on the radio, not on TV or anything. This is sort of the late 1980s. I said, well, how can that be? I mean, what about our sexual rights? And they all looked at me, you have no sexual rights. I mean, well, how can that be? I said, you go read the Constitution, you have no sexual rights. The only sexual related right we have is a right to privacy. And that's not in the Constitution either. What had happened in a case called Grizzle versus Connecticut in the 60s was that Supreme Court Justice Douglas said, you know, there have to be this idea of emanations called penumbra from existing rights that would suggest that, and he was referring to married couples must have a right to privacy to make contraceptive-related decisions in their bedroom. What was happening at the time was, in Connecticut, condoms were illegal. The silly thing about the law was, actually, they were legal if you said you're using them to protect from sexually transmitted disease. But if you said you're using for contraception, you're violating the law. And the significance of that was that Planned Parenthood wanted to promote condoms as part of its contraceptive education and counseling, and couldn't do it. You know, they couldn't skate under that kind of funny thing. So that the executive director of Planned Parenthood and a Yale physician was in New Haven. Both got arrested. In this case, Grizzle versus Connecticut went up there. And that's how we got the right to privacy. But it was for married couples. So it wasn't extended to anybody but married couples. Then finally it became unmarried couples. Unmarried couples had this right to privacy, basically the zone of privacy. It's sort of like, you know, you lock the door so your parents can't come in. It's not like they're agreeing with what you're doing or you have the right to what you're doing. It's just the door is locked and they can't get in. Then it was extended. The right to privacy was the argument in Roe versus Wade, that women had a right to, that was their right. They were the fetus, not a person, so nothing happened in that rights generation. Then it was applied to teenagers and so forth, but they drew the line for gays and lesbians. In an 88 case, they said, you know what, there's been a long history of pathologizing homosexuality. They don't have a right to, gays and lesbians, no right to privacy whatsoever. So they engage in, if in their bedroom they're having same gendered sex, they might as well be shooting heroin together. There's no protection for privacy if you engage in a felony offense. That was overturned in 2003 in Lawrence versus Texas, but it still had the same kind of governmental perspective on it. It would say, well, you know, in the privacy of the home, does that mean if they went camping, they didn't have it? Or if they were in a hotel room? And there are other variations of it. And many times where we've allowed the government to decide what our sexual ethics or morals should be, you know, they've said in the 60s that you couldn't marry someone of a different race. And the judge said, you've probably heard this quote before, but the judge said, you know why you can't marry someone of a different race? Because God decided that. God put the races on different continents. That's why. They're never meant to intermarry. And the Supreme Court eventually turned that over. But, you know, even their view on marital rape, the belief was that consent to marriage was a consent to perpetual sexual availability. So there can never be marital rape, marital assault, whatever else. Now, almost all states got rid of that in recent times, except Kentucky. Kentucky, there still can never be prosecuted for marital rape. And you don't have to be legally married. If you're living together as man and wife, there's an absence of marital rape laws. So in elevating the Ninth Amendment, what I'm hoping to do is create this sphere of personal autonomy where you get to choose about your sexual life. And one of the values, once you elevate something to a right, or like a fundamental right, not only does it give you the privilege of liberty, but it also limits the restrictions the government can put on you or the actions it does to try to limit what you're doing. So for instance, if you have a freedom of speech, the government is limited in how it can limit your speech. So most of what I talk about and write about in the Ninth Amendment falls in deaf ears. The Supreme Court basically says, you know, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but, you know, you open the door for sexual rights, people are going to want marijuana rights, people are going to want whatever else. The law tends to be precedent-based. You know, that's not the way we think about it. Now, actually, in Griswold versus Connecticut, there was a Supreme Court justice who made a Ninth Amendment argument, Goldberg. But the next year, he was made our ambassador to the United Nations and left the court. So the one champion who was on the court who took the Ninth Amendment ultimately got out. But I keep pursuing in this. And so having done this work on sexual rights and worked in sexuality more generally, I also got, in some sense, inadvertently involved in the world of sexual harm. And the way it happened was that in 1979, I started working on a book about the impact of sexual abuse. And it was a young woman who was a student in my class, and she just wanted to tell me the story where she had incest with her father and been raped by a stepfather, and she was an adolescent prostitute. And the book was about really her psychological survival. And after that book came out, I got brought into a case in Los Angeles, a very big preschool case. And this was in the early 80s. And there was a famous one that many people have heard of, which was the McMartin nursery school case. This was not the McMartin case. In the McMartin case, there was the debate, did it really happen, and there are problems with the evidence and so forth. In the case that I was brought into, the police, it was a husband and wife that ran a nursery school. And the husband had a PhD in biochemistry, and he kind of ran opened the school and kind of closed it up in the end and would sometimes play with the kids, but the wife really ran the school. And but he would take the kids off the ground saying he's going to bring them for ice cream. And he would actually take them to his house and take pornographic slides of them and all these other kinds of things. And he named and dated every slide. And the police found them all. Over 3,000 slides. So you had a documentary record of every single thing, and his hands were in the slides and whatever else. You had a documentary record of when these things happened, how long, or what time period, and so forth. And I mean, some kids, you know, said, you know, this guy went home and told their mother, his name was James. James took these nude pictures of me today. And they'd come in and confront the wife. And James would always take pictures of them in their pretty dresses, whatever. He's like, God, I don't know what they're talking about. I took this picture. So he did a lot to kind of deflect what he's doing. But having been involved in that case with 24 kids, it wasn't like a therapist who, you know, an adult is reconstructing what happened to them as a child. This year had a complete documentary record of what happened. And I spent about 4 years with these kids. And after having that sort of basis and understanding of the impact of these things, without ever having a kid testify or talk about it, I started getting drawn into a lot of these sorts of cases. And just sort of nightmarish. I was involved in the case that it was a law enforcement mom. She worked in a juvenile detention center. And she ultimately had this romantic relationship with a 17-year-old after he got out of jail. What they did with their 6-year-old was just mind-boggling. And I talked about the case briefly in my sex and law class, a very sanitized version of it. I had a student faint, another scream out, the paramedics come, and they made two calls to the paramedics. So two paramedics were coming and worked on, you know, a lot of the clergy abuse cases. And also the biggest one, I guess the biggest individual settlement, there was a young schizophrenic man, teenager, kind of in the prodromal stage, where it's sort of the onset of it. And he went to see a priest because he was so disoriented, and the priest ultimately asked him to lay down on a coffee table. and take off his clothes and whatever. And he doesn't recall the exact details that happened after it. But when he went home, he a couple weeks later, he heard a voice that said, "If thy hand offends thee, cut it off." He went in his bathroom, shut the door, and sawed his hand off. Screaming. In his mind, he was just... And I met him years afterward. The hand had been sewn on, and you know, I was watching him kind of move it, and we talked about it and that kind of stuff. But he said, you know, I only heard the voice in my head, but my roommate heard all the screaming, and they all got a friend, they pounded down the door. And I could kind of go through the horror show, and if you have questions, I can kind of answer about that. But that led me to another point when talking about sexual ethics. And the Surgeon General of the United States put out a call in, I think it was 2003 or something, about, you know, it's about time that we had an open, responsible dialogue about sexuality and sexual values and ethics. And so I decided to, you know, take that to heart and look at what I would think would be the, you know, set of ethics for the 21st century. And I originally titled the book, it was Responsible Sex Revisited, Six Ethical Principles of the 21st Century. But Oxford didn't like that title. I said, that's kind of a snoozer. So we're going to call it Sex Appeal, Six Ethical Principles for the 21st Century. And the first one is the only one I'm going to talk about. And it's do no harm. Can you imagine what a different world this would be if there was no sexual harm? And in the world that I work in, like, you know, I worked in a case with a little league coach who'd sexually abused 250 kids, admitted it. I mean, the whole story is actually nuts. But they were all boys. And many of the sizable portion of the priest abuse cases are boys. And from my perspective, certain the cases I get, there's an equal amount of there's a gender equality in the victimization of kids and the sexual abuse. But when you're thinking about sort of world's pandemics, you know, or other sort of critical issues like poverty and global warming, whatever else, it would be, imagine what a different world this would be, or what a wonderful world it would be if we could eliminate sexual harm. And so the first principle in this, and what I talk about largely, is do no harm. I mean, that's the perspective that physicians are taught. That's a perspective in Buddhist philosophy. And, you know, it's this sort of general point of view about this. And the kind of specifics in working with it, helping to prevent harm, I mean, one of the things that I've also written about is the importance of truth in disclosure. One way you can prevent it, you may not be prevent the individual act, but you can prevent subsequent acts by disclosing. And if you think of pedophilia, like somebody's going to sexually abuse a kid, and historically, we always thought of this as there was a just say no. That was the protocol. Just say no. I mean, you think of this like a 7-year-old kid, an adult's going to sexually abuse, and the kid says no. And you know, would an adult listen to that? Would an adult kind of circumvent that? Find other ways of doing it, and so forth. And it also, I mean, that perspective from my vantage point misses the point of the way kids are generally sexually abused. It's under the guise of affection. If an adult wants to sexually abuse a kid, they would just touch him within seconds or do whatever else they're going to do in seconds. The kryptonite to the abuser is disclosure. The kids are going to go tell a teacher, the kids are going to tell their parents, and so forth. So this idea of grooming, spending a lot of time and developing affectionate relationship and so forth with kids, is really to preclude or minimize the prospect of disclosure. Disclosure is the critical thing that you need to teach kids. And then kind of elevating this to something that's going on our UC campuses. The failure to disclose sex crime on campus is perpetuating it as well. By emphasizing what's going on here, what the risks are here, what you need to talk about, also as a preventative. So, I mean, from my perspective, a good public service announcement would get police officers, to get doctors, to get teachers, to get everyone else, come forward and just say, one after another. I was sexually abused as a kid. You got to speak up. Speak up. If it ever happens to you, you got to speak up. Tell someone. Tell your parents, tell your teacher, and so forth. You need a climate of disclosure. And reporting of sex crimes, there has to be a climate of disclosure as well. And one of the things that I've started doing a number of years ago was, and segueing into this music part, I became interested in finding another vehicle for promoting the messages that I've talked about so far, and particularly to other audiences, because by and large, academics speak to each other, sort of like, you know, preaching to the choir, or maybe they speak in classrooms or to other groups like this. But to have these kind of messages go beyond that, we need another way of doing this. So one way I did it is I write for the LA Weekly. And I wrote about sexual abuse. And I wrote an article titled Condoms Suck, because I felt that we weren't putting enough money into condoms. I mean, I don't know how many years we've spent trying, billions and billions of dollars trying to get a preventive HIV vaccine, never to get it. But we put no money into condoms. Then a former Surgeon General back and said, chastising me for doing it and whatever else. I wrote a second article saying, condoms still suck. She was saying that, you know, it's been proven, condoms feel really good. And she cited some study. I went and found the study. It was supported. The funding was by Trojan. So that was one way I did it. And the other way of doing it is with this band, Crying for Kafka. And it's an unusual band. It's three PhDs, one of whom is a postdoc in mechanical engineering at UCSB. They're in the room here tonight. Another is a professor of philosophy at Santa Barbara City College. And the other is a music teacher at a local school here. And we create this pro-social music that many of these ideas are embedded in. It's, you know, like there was an old song about a trumpet playing band. We're not a trumpet playing band. We're not a cover band. We're kind of in your face kind of band. As we're rolling into finishing the hour, and I'm happy to talk for as long as you want, any questions you want, I'll play a little bit of the way we try to integrate these various worlds of that message, speaking up about sexual truth, whether it's harmful or one sexual rights. I mean, in some ways, the empowerment of gay rights has been from the speaking up about it. Because when I looked at it from certainly historically in the academic world, there was like, if we could only find a gene that showed that this was like skin color or eye color, something like that, or show that, you know, other cultures have a different point of view. You know, those sorts of things may have had some effect, but it was really so the culture changed. There became much more of an openness about it, a willingness to step forward and talk about one's sexuality. So the name of this song is Unchained Verite, or Unchained the Truth.
Close to the truth, afraid to tell the infidel, I miss the promise.
We have a lot of fun with that. So I have many cases I could talk about. I'm working now with the for the California Attorney General's office, and it's sex slavery, sex trafficking, sex slave issues, and a number of other sort of things, which I usually have an entire semester to talk about this, and so I'm kind of reduced it down to an hour. But I'm happy to open it up and answer any questions you might have, or thoughts, comments, etc.
If you do have a question, there should be two microphones going around. We ask that you use...
I'm a 28-year-old undergrad, and I heard about your book about how you argue that teachers should be allowed to date their students. You're talking about in the academy. And you use an example of how, like, other differences in power, like being of different classes, doesn't interfere with consent. But my question is, isn't there something about the teacher-student relationship that's sort of like a supervisor, that's sort of a different kind of power?
Yeah. I wrote a book called The Romance in the Ivory Tower, The Rights and Liberty of Conscience. The way this started was UC at some point in time decided it was going to change its bylaws about sexual relations between faculty and students. And by the way, you know, at UCLA, you know, I don't know what the average age of a student might be, 28, because, you know, we have med schools, we have law schools, we have public health and all the graduate students and so forth. And the precipitating event was that the dean of law at UC Berkeley raped a student or sexually assaulted a student. You can Google this. But that sent UC into... fast action. We got to do something different. And from my perspective, the something different was to protect their vulnerability to civil litigation. So, but in doing so, they said, well, we're going to have this new policy, and we're going to get faculty feedback on this. So since I'd written the book previously called Sexual Rights in America, a colleague and I thought, well, you know, we should really read this and write what we think about it. Because when you talk about faculty-student relations, particularly at a major university like this one, you're not only, I mean, Hollywood presents it as a 40-something guy and a 21-year-old girl, but, you know, most romances grow out of familiarity, like-minded interests, and so forth, and it's more sort of common for faculty, grad student, or those sorts of things, where the sort of, or TA in a student, where it's sort of closer age match. But anyway, so I wrote this long priestess about the policy, and they said you need to have it in by, let's say it was May 5th, and so I got it in by May 3rd, and you know, I had it stamped and postmarked and whatever else for that. The next day, the LA Times wrote an article. 3 weeks previously, the regents voted to change the policy without any faculty feedback whatsoever. So their request for feedback was disingenuous. They had no interest in faculty feedback. They're just going to go ahead and do this. So then I wrote an LA Times op-ed piece about this. And when I wrote, basically telling this little story to you, and they were interested in it, and I eventually went through the whole process. And maybe it was like the day or second, a couple days before it was supposed to come out, the editor who was working with me on this sent me some material to read the final draft of this. But what he sent me also had all the correspondence below it that went on previously, some of which I had never seen before. And the first question on that was when I submitted this idea, was, should we give this pervert a chance? And so I thought, well, I should have fun with this. So I wrote back. He said, you know what? I got this letter from you guys, and then I read the stuff in the bottom. And the first one was, should I give this pervert a chance? So I think, well, am I a pervert? As I talked about myself, whatever else, and everybody in the LA Times, from the editor-in-chief to whoever, called me to apologize and said, oh, this just gallows humor. We're so sorry, Dr. Emerson. We love this, whatever. But all these sort of things conspired to make me think, you know, I should really write a book about this. And so what the book is really about is our rights and liberties of conscience. That is, although the first part is really about sort of these relationships, Is there that, as I talked about the Ninth Amendment, is there that zone of personal autonomy that we have complete jurisdiction over about who to romance? By the way, the UC policy equates romance and sex. So it's not specific to just sex. It says a romantic or sexual relationship with anyone who could potentially be your student. So, you know, this was so broad, it was like, you know, what if you wanted to pray with somebody, would they say the same thing? And what I recommend instead was that if a professor and a student become attracted to you as they're going to be romantic, the professor needs to recuse himself or herself to, again, I'm about truth and disclosure, disclose to the chair that you know, this is someone I'm going to have a romantic relationship with. Can you find someone else who can do the grading? Can they transfer to another class and so forth? It's not, because, you know, academia is a fierce competitive environment, and you know, it's not going to be a level playing field if somebody's romantically involved with someone in the class. So the work was never about condoning this per se. It was really giving the sort of the intellectual, emotional entitlement to consenting adults to make choices about romance. I mean, all kinds of, should a doctor never be involved with a nurse? And you could go on and on with these sort of power balances, whatever else. And sometimes these are called anti-fraternization laws. Some businesses have them. Like I remember historically, IBM. You couldn't date, if you worked at IBM, you couldn't date anyone at IBM. Ben and Jerry's was just the opposite. If they fall in love, just great. Just come tell us. We'll be really happy about it. Southwest Airlines was happy about people being romantically involved. So the book really kind of deals about, again, that sphere of personal autonomy where you get to make a choice about your life.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.